I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This podcast exists because of the fine folks at DecodingTV.com. Become a paid member at DecodingTV.com, help to support the show, and get ad-free episodes as well as early access to episodes. Thanks so much to everyone at DecodingTV.com who makes this podcast possible.
Turn around.
I am not gonna...
Turn around!
You should count yourself lucky there, Pete. Could have torn your arm off, smashed your head in, ripped out your liver, made your spine into a belt.
I ain't scared. You get back too, or you're both going hungry.
Instead, we barely gave you a concussion. That means we like you. That means you're a friend. That means when we break out of here again, we don't kill you. As long as you keep us in good food.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Streaming, a Decoding TV podcast. I'm David Chen, and my favorite way to rearrange atoms is into podcast form. Joining me today, you have seen her video essays on YouTube as Jessie Gender. She's also been a somewhat regular co-host this fall on Decoding TV, something I'm very grateful for. Jessie Earle, welcome back to Decoding TV.
Hey, I'm glad to be here, and I have collected all the different versions of myself across the multiverse, put them into my brain, and now have a deep desire to get revenge against you, David. So,
well, those are, of course, all in reference to the fact that today on This Week in Streaming, we're going to be discussing Invincible Season 2, the first four episodes. Now, typically what we do on This Week in Streaming is we talk about the first couple episodes, and then we come back at the end of the season and talk about the whole season, but... The Invincible Season 2 schedule was weird. The first four episodes have come out now, and then, but like by the time you're listening to this, they'll all have been out. And then the next four are coming out in 2024. Is that right, Jesse?
Yeah. They said early 2024, I believe.
Yeah. So, we're going to be discussing Invincible Season 2 today, the first four episodes. We're going to start with overall thoughts. Then we're going to do a detailed recap and spoil the entire season. You can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. Find us across all platforms, YouTube, Instagram, Threads, at DecodingTV. And of course, email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of the podcast and your feedback on Invincible Season 2, what you thought of the first four episodes. So let's get into it, Jesse. Now, before we even talk about any Invincible Season 2, I want to hear a little bit about your fandom or followership or engagement with Robert Kirkman's Invincible comics. I think you've enjoyed them in the past. And so can you tell us about what your relationship with Invincible as a franchise has been and what your thoughts were on the first season?
Yeah, so I actually, when I saw the first season of Invincible, I hadn't read any of the comics at all, so I actually got to watch that season very fresh, along with pretty much most of the people who watched that season, and really, really adored it. I thought it was a fantastic first season that felt really kind of fresh, and while similar to The Boys, which is Amazon's other superhero series that also is like very... based on an older 90s comic that was very edgy, that sort of is updated for sort of television. I found it to be have its own unique voice, have its own unique feel to it that felt very Game of Thronesian in its sort of ability to weave in a bunch of different characters across the entire world, also delivering very surprising storylines and things like that. And so I just thought it was really, really smart storytelling that felt like it had a real drive to it. And because I loved the first season so much, I actually picked up the entirety of the Invincible comic run between seasons one and two and read the entire thing. And really, really, really loved the comics as well. I think there's a lot of things that I have criticisms of in the comics, mostly rooted in the fact that it came out in the early 90s. So there's some storytelling choices and things in that run that I think are just rooted in the time period of which it was written. But even then, it felt like a really great sort of commentary on superhero comics generally that I think the show did a great job of updating. And like, I could see like the choices that were made in the adaptation that I think were very smart. I made me appreciate season one even more. So yeah, I overall, I think Invincible just as a franchise is a really intriguing one and one I'm really excited to dive more into.
I think you're kind of burying the lead there a little bit, Jesse. I think, you know, very minor spoilers for...
Yeah, I didn't want to say too much.
But. Invincible season one. We're not going to get into season two yet, but I think that... I mean, it's just a spoiler for episode one of Invincible season one, right? So, but essentially, Amazon has become the platform for what if Superman was a psychopath?
All right. Yeah, I wasn't sure if I wanted to break that
between
Celia,
the boy. But... Well, I think it's part of the show.
I think
we have to spoil Invincible season one to give overall thoughts on season two.
Fair. Yeah,
or at least the first episode, you know, of season one. But between Omni-Man and Homelander, it's what if the person who was the most Superman-esque character in the universe actually had more terrible designs on the human race than we'd previously been led to believe.
And both became Mortal Kombat characters, which is kind of hilarious.
That is a fact. What, in my opinion, separated Invincible season one from many other shows, many other American shows, you know, not to say like there's no other American shows like this or there's no other shows in the world like this, but it is a willingness to depict ultra violence, you know, a willingness to depict what happens when a superhero acts on a human body, basically, and kind of one thing is made of an unstoppable material and one thing is made of flesh and bone. And I realize that as I'm talking about this, it's very similar to what I praised Gen V for when we talked about it right here on Decoding TV, you know, and it's very similar. It's like, when superheroes fight with humans, they often completely annihilate them and leave nothing but bone and viscera, you know?
Yeah.
And Invincible was never afraid to shy away from that and probably did so to an even greater extent than certainly had a bigger body count than many episodes of The Boys and Gen V.
There's that one sequence in, like, I am not a very squeamish person, but there's that one sequence at the end of season one where Nolan sort of holds Mark through a subway car, and I was legit just like mortified by that. See, in a great way, like it was very effective at just showcasing how disposable humans were to a character like Nolan, that you could see why he would become the sort of like fascist asshole that thinks he's above everybody else. And it was just a really, really like it uses violence in a very effective way to sell what it's trying to say with its characters, which, you know, especially based on the comic, the comics, like it's very smartly utilizing that violence.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly in season two when we get to it, I do wonder, is this excessive? You know, is this gratuitous, right? Like, was this really necessary to make the point? Those are questions I have when I'm watching season two a little bit. But I would say largely Invincible season one, I found to be refreshing, a breath of fresh air in the genre. I actually went and acquired the Invincible comic as well after watching the first season and started reading it. And I found it to be quite faithful in reproducing many of the elements from the comic, right? I mean, it's a pretty faithful adaptation. And the comic is therefore already really strong and unique and original. I was overall a fan of Invincible season one as well. And in between season one and season two, there was an Adam Eve special that came out. Jesse, did you have a chance to check that out? Or
I did. I actually thought it was pretty good. I thought it was, you know, for just a like tied the fans over sort of thing. I thought it was a really good look at Adam Eve, and I think she was a character who felt a little nebulous in season one. Yeah. Like she was very well handled within the show, but you didn't really get a sense of what her deal was. And I think that special sort of solidified that a little bit more, and I think did a decent job of it. So I liked it. I think people should check it out if you haven't watched it.
Yeah, so we kind of learned a little bit more about the backstory of that character, and now we arrive at Invincible Season 2. So I think we can give overall thoughts on Invincible season two without spoiling season two, but I do think we have to spoil season one, or else it'll just be too vague to even really be comprehensible. But essentially, so here we go. Let's get into our overall thoughts on Invincible season two, and we are going to reveal what happens at the end of Invincible season one. So spoilers, here they come. But the end of Invincible season one concludes with a shocking revelation that Omni-Man is not actually here just to help us out, us humans. He actually comes from a planet called Viltrum, I believe it is, right? And he's a Viltrumite.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he was actually sent on a mission to prepare Earth for its enslavement by Viltrum. And I guess part of that involved marrying someone on Earth and having a child with someone on Earth. Maybe, you know, TBD. I think we learned this season whether or not that was really part of the scope of the brief. But whatever the case, he reveals that it was him who was responsible for all the deaths of those superheroes at the beginning of season one of Invincible. And he and Invincible face off in a massive battle that claims many lives. And it leaves with essentially Omni-Man fleeing Earth and going into exile because Invincible guilted him out of destroying everything. Right? That's how season one ends. Am I describing that? Damn.
Yeah, no, that's accurately? It's like that's very accurate and gave us one of the most memeified moments of the past few years.
Right? Yeah.
The Omni listen Man, mark or whatever.
Omni-Man screaming at Invincible became an online meme, which is really cool. It's always nice to see when that happens. So, anyway, a lot of questions about what's going to happen in season two of Invincible. Now, Jesse, do you know, like, do you already know how the story resolves, having read the comic?
I've read the entire comic run. So unless they do something radically different, which, again, I won't spoil the go-ahead in...
Yeah.
I won't spoil anything of season two so far, and when we get into actual spoiler discussion, I won't spoil ahead I know in the comics. But that being said, everything that I saw in this season so far was fairly faithful to what the comics are, so I don't expect they're going to make any radical deviations. I think some of the biggest changes were just like when certain story elements come up, just in terms of episode structure. But otherwise, it's the storylines of themselves pretty much the same.
Right. I have not read the comics, so I do not know. And so we have the dynamic where one person's a book reader and one person's not, as usual. So, Jesse Earle, what were your overall thoughts on season two of Invincible?
I think this season is suffering from kind of what it has to do to tell this story. Jumping off of season one, it had such a powerful momentum with this sort of mystery of what Nolan was doing and sort of all leading to that big confrontation and reveal. And this season kind of has to deal with the emotional fallout of all of that, which I think is the smart way to go because the show is so character-centric, but it leaves the plot feeling fairly aimless. And the release schedule for this season, I don't think did the show any favors whatsoever because we only get four episodes. And again, not spoiling too much, but the momentum really only picks up really right towards the end in terms of the plot getting into gear of the ends of these four episodes. And then you have to wait. Now I have to wait another, you know, however many months till we get the next part of the season. And I think that's really going to do a disservice because while I think a lot of the character stuff we get throughout this season so far is decently strong and I'm engaged and I like these characters. I like seeing what's going on with them and what they're dealing with. I think overall, I'm just sort of like, when are we going to get to the next like moment? Like what's propelling us forward? And we don't really get there until right at the end. And I think it really just, it leaves the series, I think, just feeling a little bit lost for a while.
I completely agree. I think there is some strong material in season two, a lot of great moments. The character work is pretty solid. Like many of the characters that we know from season one, their plot lines or their development advances in ways that are that make a lot of sense or are satisfying season two, but very little happens in terms of the actual plot that we care about, which is what is the aftermath between Omni-Man and Invincible? Like very little actual events in that storyline actually take place. And so that is a disappointment. I agree with you. We won't know until early 2024 what how this resolves, at least in the context of the show. But that it did feel a little bit like a show that was treading water a little bit, even though, ironically, it had very little time with which to accomplish. It had four episodes, and it feel like it didn't move with much urgency during those four episodes to get a lot accomplished. So
yeah, and I think it kind of goes to the problem of the adaptation aspect of it, because, you know, reading the comics, you know, they would release issue by issue. So when I would read an issue, like one episode of one issue of the comic would be like, you know, one third of an episode here. So it kind of felt like a full complete story when I was reading issue by issue, and even though it wasn't moving the overall plot forward. But here, because there's like four episodes and you're trying to condense a whole bunch of comic arcs into them, and they're shoving a bunch of different storylines together, it just doesn't feel as complete of a story in and of itself that will then get back to the larger plot later on, that I think comics, I think, can facilitate a little bit more.
Yeah, sorry, just so you can measure that out again, one comic is the equivalent of how much of an episode?
Like a third of the episode. So like there's a, I won't spoil, again, I'm not going to go into specifics, but like in episode two, there's like a storyline that involves fish folks. That whole storyline, which is like takes up like the last third of the episode, that's just like an issue. In the comics. So, in which, like, you read that storyline in an issue of the comics, like, oh, I felt like I got a full complete story that had a little mini arc for Mark in that tale. But here it's sort of like, oh, it's a part of an episode that now feels like it's just like part of a bunch of other storylines that are ongoing that aren't really moving the larger plot forward. Whereas a comic's like, yeah, I got a story that feels like it fully completes.
It might take you like an hour to read a comic, right?
Exactly.
Whereas like it occupies 15 minutes of space in one episode in the show. And so the fish storyline might be like, oh, that was great. But like here, it's like, oh, that now it's over. And we're on to another, you know, so yeah.
And I think comic fans also, too, are used to things being more episodic in terms of like how things get back to the major plot arc storyline. You know, it's like, oh, we'll go like 6 months to a year with like just some backstory filling, like little like one-offs. And then we'll get back to like the bigger arc later on. Whereas, like, when you get a TV show, you kind of just want it to focus on, especially when you only get 8 episodes and you don't have, like, 26 episode seasons, you kind of just want it to get to the meat of what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, those are our overall thoughts on Invincible Season 2.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's get into what actually happened this season, Jesse. Let's talk about our detailed recap of events of season two. Now, what Jesse has done is organize this into 5 parts. So we're just going to, or actually it looks like 6 parts. Going to talk about like part by part, and then sort of talk about the implications of each part. So I'll start, and then we'll take turns like recapping some things and kind of talking about what happens in each section, reflecting on it. So let's get into it. Season 2 begins on an alternate Earth where Mark sided with his father, Nolan, a.k.a. Omni-Man, after the climactic events of Season 1, where they kill the last surviving members of the Resistance movement against them. However, one Resistance member, Angstrom Levy, is saved by an alternate superpowered universe-hoping self, who brings him to safety in our universe, where he's been collecting his alternative selves in order to build a machine to combine their knowledge into his brain so he can advance Earth and save other planets. Let's pause for one moment here, Jesse. You know, one of the things that I've realized is a key component, I think, of Invincible is cruelty. You know, there's this idea of what's the most messed up stuff we can think of to do to people. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think on the one hand, like I'm interested in seeing that kind of stuff. Like, I want to see what the depths that humanity can plumb are. Like, that's kind of interesting to me. I do think, you know, on a rare occasion, like, I do feel like Invincible, the show, might take things a little bit too far. And this opening sequence of episode one kind of impacted me in that way, where he figures out a way to paralyze his friend, Adam Eve. And
yeah.
So he like refuses to kill her and says, oh, we'll just keep her alive forever so I can like visit her every now and then, which is like a really disturbing, upsetting thought, you know, that someone could be that cruel and sadistic.
Yeah.
On the one hand, it's like, okay, yeah, I respect that the show's trying to make this like cruel and uncaring universe. There's a deep, you know, tiny part of me that's like, was that really necessary? You know, like, wasn't just like exterminating all humans like enough to make the point?
Yeah. I think it does serve a point, because the whole season Mark is sort of worrying about how he might become like his father, especially mm-hmm. because he is this sort of he is functionally immortal, he learns, and he is stronger than everybody else. So he sort of worries, like, will I start to view people as less than, as like not worth my time? Will I see them like ants, like my father does? And his father literally calls his wife a pet at the end of season one, calls Deborah a pet. And so I think that this whole opening sequence is supposed to show us like the danger that Mark could fall into with that. And I think that that moment specifically kind of also showcases and highlights that moment of cruelty is not just mass murder and like, you know, just genocide. It is also how you view people as just objects for your own use. And as gross and disgusting as that moment is with Adam Eve, I think it goes to show the lack of empathy a lack of empathy for others who are different than you can lead someone to.
Yeah, I'll just say that's not a critique of the show. I'm not trying, I wasn't trying to critique the show. I think I was just saying, like, I felt a little bit uncomfortable by it, and I was wondering, you know, I was trying to interrogate my own discomfort. Like, do I just need to get on board more with what the show is doing, or is the show taking it a little too far? But you've defended the plot point rather well. And
I wasn't trying. You're wrong. How dare you? No, how dare you have emotions for people?
No, I guess I feel like I have a pretty wide tolerance for this. Like, I didn't blink at all during most of season one until maybe that subway scene. And even then I'm like, okay, yeah, that all fits in with the plot of like, or the themes of what they're trying to do. And then it was when we start, maybe I've been away from this world for too long. But then when season two starts, I'm like, is this really, you know,
I thought
we already made this
moment.
Point in season one, you know, like that's kind of what, you know, came to mind, but this is an alternate universe of Mark, and it does imagine what he could have been. Anyway, well defended, Jesse. Our universe's Angstrom Levy breaks the Mahler twins out of prison to help him build this machine that he wants to build. Cecil sends Mark to stop Levy and the Mahler twins, but Angstrom stops the transfer early, causing an explosion that kills his other selves and leaves him terribly scarred, leaving him mad and vowing revenge on Mark. We see him throughout the rest of the season visiting Mark's in different universes to learn Invincible's weaknesses. So that's kind of the main plot of episode one, is we're multiverse hopping, and there's many mm-hmm. universes in which Mark and Omni-Man teamed up and destroyed Earth together. And there's some in which like Earth survived. And in those universes, it was often Invincible that was able to repel Omni-Man and stop Earth from being enslaved. So an interesting idea. And I'm curious to see where it goes. And I, you know, a lot of the art direction and the design of this stuff is really cool. This whole cascading chain of Angstrom Levy's on this gigantic machine is like a cool idea and a cool visual. I liked a lot of ideas in this whole plot line. Jesse, any reaction to this?
Yeah, I think Angstrom Levy is an interesting character because he's sympathetic in the sense that he's someone who wants to try to make the world better. And it sort of gives us, again, these sort of like a look at these stakes in other universes and sort of the places that we can go. And I think it's a, you know, this is 2023 where I'm kind of, you know, kind of petered out on the multiverse stuff, especially when it comes to superhero-dom. So here, at least the multiverse stuff is not taking the center stage and feels like it's being utilized for an interesting function. So I do appreciate that. It's not taking over the plot. and being used to just mash together IPs or something like that. My only real note with what we see so far with Levy, beyond the fact that he's only really in episode one and then sort of takes a background when it feels like he could have been kind of more foregrounded to give the first half of this season more propulsion until Omni-Man shows back up, is also that it does kind of fall into that, like, look, we have this horribly scarred villain trope that, like, you know, disability scarring equals madness and villainy, you know, the sort of equating of those two things, which, you know, it kind of goes back to my critique of, like, the comic from the 90s. It's just like, it's not like the worst thing in the world, but it is just one of those tropes that's like, oh, yeah, I think we hopefully kind of moved past this, unless you're a James Bond movie at this point. That's my only real knock against this overall, but he's an intriguing enough villain that I just wish had been foregrounded a little bit more just to get the season propulsion.
I think what was surprising to me was, like, I'm so curious where this multiverse stuff is going, because I heard before I watched this that there was going to be multiverse stuff in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the obvious place to go with that is, oh, they need to figure out a way to stop Omni-Man from doing all the stuff he did in season one, right? Like,
yeah,
killing all the heroes and then destroying the city and everything like that. Like, they need to go back and prevent that from happening. But that doesn't even seem to be really in the equation. It's mm-hmm. really just, how do we stop any impending invasion from the Viltrumites in the future? That seems to be what Angstrom Levy wants to prevent, is my sense.
Yes.
Not like, let's go back and undo all the terrible things that have happened already, which would be kind of like
Endgame, like,
yeah. And I was gonna say, like, an Avengers end, that's where I thought it was going, kind of an Avengers mm-hmm. Endgame style, you know. But it's not, it's just which to me makes me wonder, like, what is even the point of the multiverse stuff at all? So far I don't feel like I have a strong sense of it, because, like, everything that's happened this season, like, or most of the stuff, as far as I can tell, could have happened with no multiverse stuff. Like, the core components of what happens with Invincible and Omni-Man could have happened with no multiverse stuff.
I definitely agree. I think it was more a novelty of the time the comic came out that was like, ooh, multiverse things. But in 2023, it just kind of feels like a played out trope that's sort of like, yeah, it's there. It doesn't feel as interesting, and so now you're sort of more questioning about it, and. I at least am on the side of, like, I like that it's not being used to, like, let's go back and do these other things, because that feels like it would undercut the stakes a little bit of what could be happening, because that's always the danger of, like, multiverse and time traveling storylines. So I'm at least appreciating the restraint, if not necessarily the novelty of the multiverse. Yeah. But yeah,
fair. So what happens next in the season, Jesse?
Well, after the events of season one, Mark is struggling to find his identity and place, believing he might be destined to follow in his father's footsteps. He argues with Cecil to let him have a place working for the U.S. government in order to feel like he's helping, which Cecil turns down. Meanwhile, Robot, aka Rudy's efficiency as a leader of the Guardians of the Globe, has faltered due to him now having a younger body that he cares about, leading Cecil to demote him from team leader. Meanwhile, Deborah, Mark's mother, gets a visit from Olga, the widow of the former Guardians member that Nolan killed, as she struggles with being abandoned and publicly dehumanized by Nolan after revealing he was a fascist mass murdering liar.
So, what were some, you know, what were your thoughts on how Mark's arc developed this season overall? I have to say, I thought it was pretty reasonable. He had a shattering event happened at the end of season one, and he kind of is drifting through life a little bit aimlessly, a little bit questioning everything, and until it kind of explodes towards the end of season two. And that all kind of struck me as very logical for where that character might be. What about you?
Yeah, I agree. Again, it's a very strong character work by the season, especially with Mark. It all makes very much sense. Like, he would worry about not only his relationship to his father and what it means to not have his father there for the first time and being this hero, but again, this sort of, like, following this path of what could I become, because he is stronger than everybody. He is different than everybody. And, you know, again, I think the series is trying to grapple with ideas of empathy, I think, is one of the major themes of the show, of how empathy is what leads us away from being able to become these sort of dehumanized, like, people who believe that we're gods or something like that. but how do you hold on to the empathy when you see difference? And so I think all of that works really, really well. And seeing him tie himself to his relationships and trying to repair all of that, it was kind of nice, because typically in arcs like this, you sort of see characters like shove people away. Like, I just being like, no, I can do this all on my own. I'm stronger. And the arc this season really feels more like he's trying to do better about balancing responsibilities. And it feels like a nice subversion of those sort of typical superhero tropes of like, I've got to do it all on my own, which I found kind of refreshing.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything else to say about those events, or shall we move on to what's next?
We can go on to the next one.
Mark finally graduates from high school along with his friends, though he almost misses his graduation due to a fight with Doc Seismic at the Washington Monument. Let's pause for a moment on this. this stuff is a little bit weird to me. The show doesn't really have a regular rhythm. You know, it'd be one thing back in the old days. You know, you'd have a
back in my day
when you have a 22 episode season. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd have like every episode was like a fairly standard formula. It's like, oh, mm-hmm. this hero takes down Doc Seismic, the Underminer, whatever, you know, there'd be like a villain of the week. And then like every four or five or six episodes, excuse me, you'd have like a mythology episode that's like, oh, now we're moving the broader plot along.
Yeah.
I've never really felt that there is a rhythm with Invincible personally. Yeah. It's very serialized. And so the idea that he's just kind of like fighting Doc Seismic as a feels very like side questy, and I'm not super invested in the outcome. It'd be one thing if it's like every week he's fighting a new villain, and that's kind of interesting, but he's kind of it's like, okay, all right, I guess he's still kind of technically a superhero, you know?
Yeah.
What do you think, Jesse?
It goes back to the comic thing, right? Like it's trying to condense what would be an issue of the comic into a
subplot
format.
Of one episode. Yeah
exactly. Yeah. And so it feels very weirdly episodic within the episode. And I think it comes across as just structurally weird.
Yeah.
Especially because there isn't like the overarching plot to really lean back on for the season.
Yeah. So anyway, Mark slowly begins to rebuild his life, reconciling with his girlfriend, Amber, who seems to understand his dual commitments. And he finds himself nominally working for Cecil and the U.S. government. He helps stop a murderous vigilante Batman knockoff and save an underwater fish kingdom from a giant beast. They first try to feed him too, but let's let bygones be bygones. Deborah, meanwhile, slowly falls into depression as she finds herself more and more isolated, especially from Mark. We see Adam Eve tries to use her power to help the community and her parents, but her father's toxic masculinity prevents him from accepting her help, and her attempts to help lead to disasters like a park she created, collapsing in on itself, hurting several people, including children. Adam Eve then attempts to become a superhero again to mixed results, leading her to still look for her identity. Meanwhile, a Martian living on Earth takes up superherodom, bringing him into contact with the Guardians of the Globe, as we also see the parasite Starro-like aliens take over the Martian civilization. Now, Jesse Earle, you wrote in this plot summary that Adam E's father's toxic masculinity prevented him from accepting her help. Toxic masculinity, Jesse, or just fear of superpowered creatures with no caring about safety or any other rules, just doing things randomly left and right, which is quite reasonable in my opinion.
I think it's a mix of both. I mean, if you watch the Adam Eve special, father is a giant asshole and definitely
yes,
is this like
true.
I have to do it all on my own. So I think it's a mixture of like reasonable, like, hey, maybe we shouldn't rely on superheroes to do all these things because they get us killed, and also being a giant asshat who has no real empathy for his daughter other than wanting to control her.
Yeah, so. That's bad. I will grant you that. I will say that I know I'm getting older, because when I first watched the trailer for one of the worst films I've ever seen, Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice.
I'm glad we're bringing it up.
There's a line in that trailer where Ben Affleck says, if there's even a 1% chance that, I'm paraphrasing here, if there's even a 1% chance that Superman... might turn against us, we have to treat it as an absolute certainty. That's what he said. And when I saw that, I was like, that's ridiculous. Superman would never. And if it is 1%, that's way too small of a chance. You know, there's a 99% chance he's going to be just fine with us. After having watched The Boys and also Invincible,
I am now
squarely in Ben Affleck's side. These superheroes must be controlled. you can put me on that senator committee, you know, trying to pass a law against X-Men, but I'm basically, you know, on the side of, hey, maybe having a bunch of superpowered creatures that don't necessarily care about human casualties isn't a good thing. So anyway,
well,
it goes
to like the Batman v Superman thing, right? Where it's like that movie had decent enough ideas, but it's terrible to do it in the property, like the thing that it's meant to uphold. Those, like, your Superman should be like this very happy-go-lucky guy and not this murderous dude that Zack Snyder wanted to make it. Whereas things like The Boys or Invincible, which are comment, or even Watchmen, are commenting on that, and you can do that there. But if you deconstruct the property within the property itself, it kind of ruins the whole point. And you
let
even see
Superman
that...
be Superman. Basically.
Exactly.
Let Superman
and even
be
here,
Superman.
They have the murderous Batman vigilante who very much feels like the Batman of those movies where he's just murdering people left and right, which this show Invincible takes as like, hey, you shouldn't be doing that. Which is in the comics itself too, and it's sort of like, oh, in the 90s they were like, murderous Batman is bad, maybe don't do that. Which is just kind of funny.
But yeah, I mean, I like the Adam Eve plotline because it shows that, hey, there's sometimes you can't just fix things with your superpowers. Like,
mm-hmm.
there are rules for a reason. There are zoning laws for a reason. So there's groundwater, you know, analyses for a reason, you know, like,
yeah.
And I like that, this idea of you can't just solve everything because you can rearrange atoms and stuff, you know,
you can't
punch your way to freedom sometimes, you know?
Yeah. The bureaucracy of universes like this are always, I always find that fascinating. Like the bureaucratic aspects of how people deal with stuff in superhero universes, just, I find endlessly just interesting to talk about. And so I think that, like seeing these little tidbits of like Adam Eve trying to do stuff and be like, no, you can't do that. Like, you'll literally ruin the pipes underneath the ground. It, like, it's just it adds to the complexity and realism of the universe in a really interesting way.
Any thoughts on the Martian subplot? I didn't really,
not really. I put it in here because it is given weight at certain points, but yeah, it doesn't really go anywhere at this point. The editing of that one sequence was very strange as well too, because there's a moment where the Martian guy is sort of giving his fake backstory to the Guardians, who, by the way, are very accepting of this random dude who just shows up. But then that him telling his fake backstory is intercut with us watching the Starro parasites infect Mars, which would seem to imply that's like, the way it's edited just seems to imply that's his backstory, because he's telling his backstory at that moment, but it's actually a concurrent event that's happening separately just to the civilization he's from. So it was just a weird editing choice that I think just didn't, like, I got it, but it was a little bit confusing, and I think it would help that I had read the comics to know, like, oh yeah, that's just a thing that's happening separately at the same time. It was very weird.
It's just a weird thing that we're apparently visiting every like 3 to 4 episodes. Like,
yeah,
it started last season where they go to space and Mars, and then it lay dormant for multiple episodes, and then it comes back again. You know, and then who knows when it's going to come back again? But I don't know.
Like, again, it's a remnant of the comic adaptation where, like, in the comic, you can have a page where it's like at the end of a comic issue, like, remember this stuff's going on Mars, and then revisit it like 6 months, 6 issues down the line. Whereas here, you have 8 episodes, and it just feels weird that you're not returning to it in any way.
Right. It's like the equivalent of how in the Eternals in the MCU, there's a gigantic hand, like a celestial hand reaching out of the ocean.
Yeah,
and
no one references it.
You know, oh, there's a shape shifting alien that kind of stowed away on a spaceship heading towards Earth. And you know, it's just
remember
the thing
that giant god appeared above Earth and picked up a single person and then left. Remember that?
Anyway, Jesse, what happens next in the show?
All right. We begin to learn more about Alan, the Seth Rogen voiced alien who works for the Coalition of Planets, the Galactic Alliance of Worlds that stands against the fascist Viltrumites. Alan was part of an experiment to create a warrior as strong as the Viltrumites, of which he was the only success. Alan tells the Coalition government about Omni-Man's abandonment of Earth and Mark, information that could help stop the Viltrumites. However, Alan is attacked and almost killed by the Viltrumites for his information, revealing that there is an informant working for the Viltrumites in the Coalition. Also, there's a lot of sex in this episode.
Yeah. you know, one of the things I really like about the show is how expansive it is in terms mm-hmm. of like all the stuff that have this galaxy. You know, you realize, oh wow, like Earth is only a tiny part of like a much bigger picture, which is mm-hmm. what we've always dreamed of. Although Fermi's paradox says that that's we don't know yet. But I think I like this episode. I thought it was pretty cool. There was a really, you know, it's a really classic cliffhanger ending of mm-hmm. oh my god, the guy who is Alan's friend might be the betrayer in the first mm-hmm. you know, it's just like, that's good stuff. Alan kind of, I guess he kind of sacrificed himself to like make sure the Viltrumites didn't hurt his friends that were dining there in that restaurant, is kind
yeah,
of
yeah I think
it's like
god
you know, he kind
yeah.
of like diverted his, and he didn't want them to find Invincible either, because if they did, then presumably, basically, Invincible is one of the only people who can holds the key to stopping Viltrumites from taking over the galaxy, and so mm-hmm. He dies rather than give up that information. Right?
Yeah,
is kind of the sense. Yeah,
yeah. It's also interesting that this character is voiced by Seth Rogen, because when I saw him initially in season one, having not read the comics, I'm like, oh, that fits like this kind of like screwball, like, oh, oops, I showed up at the wrong planet for years sort of guy. Fit Seth Rogen really well. But then when they sort of take it in this episode and make him much more of a like classic hero figure, the Seth Rogen aspect of that character doesn't seem to fit at all. It just seems like a weird shift in the character that like didn't work for Seth Rogen to be voicing the character, especially after reading the, I was even reading the comics and I was like, this, I can't hear Seth Rogen voicing this. And now having seen this put to animation, I'm like, it still feels a little weird to me.
You know, it didn't bother me. I think Seth Rogen's like showing his range here. And I think that, you know, a lot of that is kind of what you bring in because of what you
yeah,
know.
Yeah. Oh,
Seth
and
Rogen,
I know I'm typecasting. Right? I'm typecasting right, right. Seth Rogen.
But it's I think just, the performance yeah. is completely fine. I don't think there's anything. He's not like goofing off when he's supposed to be serious or anything like that. I think it's a very solid performance. And, you know, Seth Rogen has kind of, I think Seth Rogen has reshaped his persona a little bit as the years have gone on. Right. He used to be kind of.
He did do that American Pickle movie, which was weirdly.
Yeah. American Pickle.
Than...
He's done like he used to be, you know, I think most people knew him from 40-Year-Old Virgin, but then he did mm-hmm. The Green Hornet. You know, he's mm-hmm. done movies like American Pickle and like really kind of tried to branch out. He's still doing a lot of the comedy stuff, but I think he's this is like a fairly dramatic role in this
yeah.
episode, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think he acquits himself very fine, very well in this episode.
Well,
so,
fine. Now yeah. now you make me feel like I'm a jerk to Seth Rogen.
Seth, if you're listening to this, we have no quarrel with you. Anyway, all right. Anything else about this whole plotline? The coalition of planets, kind of an interesting idea of these people trying to stop the Viltrumites. I wish I had a better understanding of how they stopped yeah. the Viltrumites. In season one, we saw Omni-Man fly into an alternate universe and literally obliterate the entire planet single-handedly, but like with just his one powers.
Yeah.
And so if you don't have anything approaching that level of power, how do you stop an Omni-Man? I would love to know, like, I would love to know how a coalition of planets actually helps instead of hurting, because it makes it so that all the planets are more easily discovered.
Yeah, that is a good point. So, yeah, I don't want to, again, this is where I'll have to like pause and yeah. not say too much because I've read yeah. the comics. But what I will say is I do, having read the comics and if the show follows that storyline, I really do enjoy how this galactic storyline develops. I think there's some interesting twists and turns in there that I'm curious to see how they'll adapt. And that's about as far as I'll say. So,
all right. Back on Earth, Deborah joins a superhero spouse support group to help deal with her depression after Nolan's abandonment, but finds she is unable to completely connect with other spouses because of Nolan's horrific actions. Deborah eventually talks to Nolan's former costume designer and friend, who reminds Deborah that she was stronger than she always thought. She was always stronger than she thought. Meanwhile, with the Guardians, Rexplode tries to reconcile with Duplicate, who has begun to date the Immortal, leaving many questions about their age gap. Robot, a.k.a. Rudy, and Monster Girl also begin to connect emotionally, going on a movie date as Rudy connects more with his humanity. Back with the U.S. government, Cecil's right-hand man, Donald, discovers he's some form of robot/cyborg or clone of the original Donald, who was killed by Nolan. All right, bunch of stuff going on here. I thought the Deborah spousal support group storyline was really mm-hmm. amazing.
Yeah.
Because it's rare to see that explored. Like the last time I can remember it being, you know, I don't watch that much superhero television, but the last time I remember it being explored was like on a show like, you know, Lois and Clark, The Adventures of Superman. Or something. You know, like yeah. we're usually told these stories from the perspective of the superhero. We rarely see what it's like for the person who is married to the superhero. You know, it's like we see Spider-Man, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, from the perspective of Spider-Man, not from Kirsten Dunst's character. You know, like, yeah. And so to see like what wreckage, what emotional wreckage Nolan's actions left behind in her life, I thought was really compelling. And when she reveals that it was her husband that killed the spouse of someone else in the group, it's a heart-wrenching moment, and it plays out very believably, in my opinion. So
yeah, you Jesse, understand you both sides of it. No, you understand both sides of that emotion, even though you feel for Deborah and like how isolated she is and how much that's going to just crush her soul even more, but you understand the other guy's reaction to that. I will say this is one of the smartest adaptations from the comic, because like I said, the comic is generally, they're fairly faithful to the comic book. This storyline is actually slightly changed from the comic in that Deborah is given much more focus. In the comic, she falls much more into alcoholism than she even does here. There's little hints of it in this show, but it's much less here than in the comic. And that's pretty much her entire storyline. She just falls into alcoholism. And then Mark sort of resents her for that, and they sort of become distant, and then stuff happens later on that I won't get into that sort of pulls into that. And so it's very much like it's very limiting to her in the comic book. She doesn't get much to do, and it's sort of centered on Mark's emotions about her as a mother failing him, and also led to the fan base at the time in the comics, I've learned, also resenting the character a lot too. And so I think that this shift in this, like, we do get to see their sense of isolation between her and Mark, but it's much less resentful between the two of them, and also is focused more on Deborah's emotion and allowing her to explore it on her own terms, that I think is just a much better update for the modern day, to like give the woman character that centrality in the narrative, that I think was really, really cool to see. So I actually really thought that this was some of the best character work the show has done, period. And for them to do that, updating a kind of not very great storyline from the comics, I thought was really excellent.
Yeah. Did they kind of have the same plot mechanics where she goes and then befriends someone and then reveals this information?
I don't remember if there was the support group for her in the comic. There may have been, but if it was, it was definitely not given the same level of focus it's given here. So
I thought it was very solid. And your heart really goes out to her because she's put in this impossible situation where she wants to tell the truth to this person, but she knows it will lead to her ostracization if she does. And she ends up deciding to tell the truth. And that seems like, you know, she's making an impossible choice, and your heart really goes out to that character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's very, very well handled.
The Rexplode duplicate robot monster girl stuff, I'm like, okay, I could take or leave. You know, it's fine. I think Rexplode is such a kind of caricature in the show that it's hard for me to get super invested in that plot. But I don't know if you have any further thoughts on that.
I generally agree. I am as a Trekkie, I'm always happy to see Zachary Quinto getting some work. I could take or leave these plot lines. I don't have many thoughts about it. I do really like the concept of Monster Girl's relationship with Rudy, in that like she gets younger, and so he's trying to, whenever she uses her power, so he's trying to help her, and that's his sort of tie back into humanity after having been, again, it goes back to that theme of empathy with the show. Like, he was someone who was very disfigured, again, a problematic storyline, and sort of distanced himself from humanity, and now that he's in a different body, he is finding connection to his humanity through connection to others. I think it that storyline ties into the show's overall themes of empathy really well, but it is sort of a side plot for the moment, so there's not much meat on the bone at the moment.
I loved all the stuff with Donald. Just a really cool idea, because he has one of the more memorable deaths in season one, which is given quite a bit of weight in all the previously on Invincible recaps that you see this season. It's memorable because basically you see Omni-Man grab Donald's spine, essentially, and then he's like about to completely annihilate Donald. But before he does that, Donald triggers an explosion that he thinks is going to kill both him and Omni-Man. Of course, Omni-Man's just fine. literally, we haven't seen anything you can throw at Omni-Man that will stop him other than kind of invincible for like 5 seconds, right? Like,
Other Omni-Men
are the only thing that can stop Omni-Man. Right?
Yeah, pretty much.
But him kind of discovering that he's, you know, watching the tape and then like started cutting into himself, like that's a really effective storyline. A very similar sequence takes place in the Alex Garland film Ex Machina, if you've seen that, where one of the characters in that movie believes he might be a robot and starts cutting into himself. And so I thought that was all great. I don't think we ever really resolve that storyline this season, do we? Like, or
no,
so far,
no.
Right?
I do think there's one really great moment where he does cut himself, and then he goes, "Oh, thank God," because he sees some blood. But then he looks in, and then there's some like circuitry underneath. I thought that was just a very well like handled scene that just tells you everything. That he just shows you how much he wanted, because he's a very silent character.
Yeah.
So when he cuts himself, sees blood, and he has that relief, he's like, "Oh, it shows you what he was feeling." And then he sees the circuitry, and then you realize the sort of horror of that. It's sort of like it compounds the tragedy of it, which I thought was really great.
Yeah. I didn't interpret it necessarily as circuitry. Like, you probably know based on your knowledge whether or not circuitry, but like it definitely felt like something potentially inorganic or maybe just non-human is really what I got from it. But I don't know exactly how I was supposed to read that. I do think you're right. He is a silent character, and what's amazing is his character design feels like a background character in an anime film. Basically, he's like the kind of character that would be like one of the people walking behind the main character in like an anime film. Like just very nondescript, very kind of plain features. And to give him a storyline where he needs to realize his own inhumanity, I thought, pretty cool. Pretty cool stuff.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I love it.
As we're talking about it, I think we're like overall quite positive like on this season. You know, I think there's a lot of good stuff here. The weaknesses, I think, so far are primarily like it crams in all these plot lines that don't necessarily get a chance to breathe, right? Like,
yeah.
So, but when it hits, it's like really when it the Deborah really, stuff hits, really hit. You know, the Donald stuff, like all that. Some of the stuff, it's very short. Like the Donald stuff is like, I'm going to say occupies 20 minutes, you know, total. In the whole season, you know,
I wouldn't even see. Yeah, I wouldn't even say
maybe
that.
Like,
maybe
like 6 minutes, you know, like maybe being like 5 to 10 minutes, you know. And
it's a good short film.
Yeah, it's a good short film. That's the thing. It's a good short film, but you know, when that stuff works, it really works really well. All right, bring us home, Jesse Earle.
All right. Despite being in college, Mark agrees to go into space to help an alien species of bug people. However, upon arriving on the planet, Mark finds his father, Nolan. Nolan reveals that after leaving Earth, he wandered disillusioned with the Viltrumite's fascist ideology, eventually landing on this bug planet, becoming their leader, and even marrying and having a child, Mark's half-brother, whom he wants Mark to bring back to Earth. Nolan also struggles with his empathy for those he taught to see as lesser species, but soon the Viltrumites arrive to kill Nolan. Mark and Nolan put up a valiant fight trying to defend the bug people, but they are eventually defeated, and the Viltrumites capture Nolan for execution and tell Mark that he must prepare Earth for takeover or the Viltrumites will murder everyone on the planet.
All right, Jesse, how do you think this plotline played out? Do you think this was well done?
I think this was great. And this was the sort of like, again, the shot in the arm of getting us into like what people are really, really here for, which is the Omni-Man Mark drama. And I think it was necessary to sort of keep him away for a significant amount of time. But it just, again, it goes to the structure of the whole season. But I thought this part hit really, really well. You get to see why Nolan was feeling the way he does in that sort of very powerful moment at the end of season one where Mark says, "I'd have you, we'd have each other." And Nolan sort of like taking that to sort of rethink his whole ideology again around empathy of like, I've thought that I was better than everybody else. And I go to this bug planet where I love these bug planet people too. Like they just live very short lives and have very different ways of seeing the world. And that just feels like such a lesser species to Nolan that he's still like, I care for them. Why do I care for them? And sort of making him rethink how he sees the world, I thought it was very well handled. And then the fight sequences were just pretty cool. We have that one Viltrumite with the like hair knife, which is pretty badass.
She has like a braided ponytail that can be used as a weapon. Yeah.
Yeah, which is pretty cool stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Viltrumites can live thousands of years, right? Mm-hmm. And these bug people live much shorter life than a human those, right? And so they value life very differently. It's interesting to see Omni-Man really struggle with himself because he sees caring for people as a massive weakness,
right? Yep.
Like, it is a huge fatal flaw that he has any empathy whatsoever. And you can tell how much of a problem that is for him. I thought the way Mark behaved was very normal, like teenager behavior. You can, you know, and I thought they took it to just the right amount where, yes, he would be a petulant teenager who's really angry at his dad because, you know, his dad did some unforgivable stuff. Murdered a ton of people and called his mom a pet. You know, like that's, it's hard to come back from that, you know? Hard to come back from that.
But even complicating that, too, because he still hugs him the first thing he sees, which I thought was an interesting, like, it was, it just shows the complexity of his relationship, which I thought was nice.
Agreed. But everything Mark does struck me as very plausible. And that's, you know, it's worth pointing out that, like, sometimes we watch something and it's it doesn't make sense why a character would do that or feels completely motivated by the script. But everything Mark does is very reasonable. He's angry at his dad. He still loves his dad. He feels betrayed that his dad has taken a bug wife and had a bug child. You know?
Very, very understandable. Who among us hasn't been able to relate to your dad abandoning your mom and going and having a bug kid, you know?
All of us have really experienced that at one time or another in our lives.
I say this having a half-sister who I love and adore very much.
Okay. Don't know why you're bringing that up, Jesse. Does it seem related to what we're talking about?
If you're listening, I love you. Please don't hate me.
Anyway, so the fight scene is excellent. And the Viltrumites issue Mark an ultimatum saying you gotta prepare Earth for takeover. And at the end of the day, I felt like the plot really hadn't moved very much from the end of the last season. Like, end of last season, Nolan and Invincible fight, and, you know, Omni-Man has Invincible dead to rights. It's like, he could literally murder him at the end of season one. But he doesn't, because he's feels a little guilty. Got that little human guilt going on.
Gosh darn empathy.
Yeah, that darn empathy. And then the Viltrumites are like, hey, guess what? That's not an option. So you're going to jail. And Mark, now you're the new Omni-Man. You know, now you got to do the thing. And it's like, okay, well, now I don't know where we're going from here. You know, like...
I like it because it adds stakes that we haven't had the rest of the season so far, in the sense that, like, oh, there's some level of, like, this is the stakes going forward that sort of are hanging over the show. And also ties into stuff with Mark, right, where his whole thing was like, I'm worried I'm going to become my dad. And now it's like, you have literally people saying, become like your dad or die, which I think fits his plot arc in a really interesting way. Or everyone you know will die, I should say.
Yeah, that was an interesting moment in the fight when Omni-Man chides Invincible for not fighting well. He says, you know, you can't. He's like, what are you doing? We're getting crushed out here. You know, he's like talking about like a basketball game. He's like, we're getting crushed out. What are you doing? Like, you have to fight these people like you're trying to kill them, or else they're going to kill you. And it's hard for Invincible to do that. And it has been hard for him in the past, and it's still hard for him now, we sense, right?
Yeah. So. And it gives us a glimpse of their ideology, too, because there's moments, too, where I think Nolan kills one of the Viltrumites, and then the other one says, like, they aren't, like, upset about that. They're like, well, he deserved to die because he didn't fight strong enough. So it's like, might makes right, you know, survival of the fittest.
It's like a very, like, Spartans, you know, in the 300. It's like, if you can't cut it, then you didn't deserve to be around. If you died in battle, you didn't really... deserve to be around, or it was an honorable, glorious death in which you're going to be honored, which is fine for you anyway. So, all right. Well, we'll have just a couple of closing thoughts, but before we do that, Jesse Earle, you want to let people know they can find more of your work on the internet?
Yeah, you can find me on YouTube at Jesse Gender. That is the name of my channel. You can also go at Jesse Gender 1, the number 1. It's where I do video essay type of stuff about kind of politics and queer issues and things like that in pop culture and media. I think early next week, I'll actually be having a video about Barbie and the history of feminism in there if you want to check that out. And critique of that film. I also have a secondary channel called Jesse Ginger After Dark, where I do news, reviews, reactions, where I've been reviewing every episode of Invincible on its own. I'm going to be reviewing other shows coming up as well, so you can check me out over there. I had an interview with the composer for Star Trek Lower Decks and Solar Opposites, so you can check that out. That just recently came out. And then I'm also on Nebula, which is the streaming service that myself and a bunch of other creators created in order to help get us, you know, promote our videos outside of the algorithm. And they are also funding my science fiction film called Identities, which is a film starring Abigail Thorne of Philosophy Tube on YouTube, as well as John Delancey from Star Trek, as well as many other folks. That'll be out early next year. So subscribe to Nebula to see that when it comes out.
All right. And I definitely recommend checking out Jesse's work. It's very enlightening and interesting. So really grateful to have Jesse here on Decoding TV. You can find more episodes at podcast.decodingtv.com and email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of the podcast and of the shows that we're covering. All right, Jesse Earle, any closing thoughts on season two? Without spoiling anything, can you say any plot lines that have been introduced this season that you're particularly looking forward to how they're going to resolve?
Yeah, I mean, the galactic stage stuff, I think, is what's really, I think, the most interesting. The stuff, the coalition of planets and the Viltrumites and how that sort of gets developed, even with my knowledge, again, no spoilers. I'm very excited to see what they're going to do with that going forward, especially now that it's sort of kicked into gear right at the end of the season. So, yeah, I think that's sort of the major stuff that I'm pumped to see brought to life, so to speak. But the overall with this first half of the season, I think it just goes to what I said at the beginning. I think all of the stuff in here is good, and I think there's really great moments and some excellent character writing throughout the show. But I think structurally it is a bit wonky and a bit of a weird adaptation of the comics. In a section of the comics that was always going to be very difficult to adapt, given it's sort of between major arcs.
Season one ends with a massive climax, right?
And exactly.
There's got to be a come down from that. And,
exactly.
You know, and then a rebuilding back up. And this season kind of accomplished that. But yeah, I agree. There's just so many subplots kind of crammed in here without much, without much logic to them, it seems to me, about like why they're here in this order, you know,
exactly
kind of what I sense. Yeah,
exactly. And I think it comes down to this, like the comics, they just had to be like, well, we have to tell these stories in this space of time, so let's just figure out how to do it. But I think the fact of splitting the season into two in this way, I think it does kill the momentum quite a bit.
Yeah.
So I think Amazon, I get why Amazon chose to release in this way, probably to be like, well, we need to get something out this year. And I'm betting you the other four episodes aren't even done yet. They're still probably finishing up some stuff. So they probably had to do it this way, at least in terms of the, like, we need to get it out by this quarter sort of thinking. But I do think that release does very much stymie its momentum. And I wish they had just released it all at once.
I feel the same way. It's interesting to me that they released the Adam Eve thing this last summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then still released Invincible this fall when they, it's like,
yeah,
they could have released Adam Eve and then like that ties us over until the new year. But, you know, who knows? They're as somebody who has literally worked at Prime Video, I know they're dealing with a lot of differing priorities and it's difficult to juggle and manage them all. So but I agree from a storytelling perspective, some great stuff. You know, my favorite stuff from the season, I agree with you. The episode 4 was overall really strong because it's a direct continuation of the first season. I thought the Deborah stuff was pretty good, you know, and by the end we should point out that she kind of decides like, I'm leaving the house and I'm doing my own thing, being my own person. And you know, that's a very reasonable subplot for that character. Coalition of Planet stuff, it's intriguing, but I just feel like we have so little of it in this season, you know. The same could be said about many other things that happened this season. Like, we're given glimpses of Adam Eve's home life and what happens with Seth Rogen's character and such, you know, like, and with Robert, the potential robot character, Donald, the potential robot character. So
Rudolph. The robot. Oh, sorry, Don. There's Robot, who is Rudolph, and then there's Donald, who might be a robot.
Both. You know, we get very little of both of those characters, and so there's some good stuff, and there's some stuff that I'm like, it's intriguing. I wish we had more of it, and I agree that the release schedule, not really loving it. That said, we hope you have enjoyed watching the show and also listening to this conversation. Check out Jesse's other work on her YouTube channel and everywhere else. But yeah, she is Jesse Earle. I am David Chen. You've been listening to Decoding TV. We will be back when Invincible Season 2 part two airs to talk about it and see how it all wraps up. So thanks so much for listening to Decoding TV. Until next time, goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.